Welcome to Old Books with Grace. I'm Dr. Grace Hammond, and I'm really happy to be doing a St. Augustine episode today. Confessions is one of my all-time favorite books. Before we get into Augustine, a few things. This is the last episode of season 3 of Old Books with Grace, which is kind of unbelievable, but true nonetheless. I want to sincerely thank you all for listening to this season. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can give to the link in the show notes, which is buymeacoffee.com/Grace Hammond. And these funds basically go straight to platform fees and books for research, things like that. But if you want to give but can't give money, then reviews and subscriptions and ratings are so helpful for me. And this podcast is a one-woman effort, and I see them, and they bring a smile to my face and help other people find the podcast. And no pressure to do either of those things if you're not interested. So, all that to say, thank you for listening. It's been a great season. I'm so thankful for all the guests that I've had. And today, in our season finale, I have Dr. Michael Lamb on. Michael Lamb is the F.M. Kirby Foundation Chair of Leadership and Character, Executive Director of the Program for Leadership and Character, and Associate Professor of Interdisciplinary Humanities at Wake Forest University. He's also a research fellow with the Oxford Character Project. He holds a PhD in politics from Princeton University, a BA in political science from Rhodes College, and a second BA in philosophy and theology from the University of Oxford, where he studied as a Rhodes Scholar. An award-winning teacher, his research and teaching focus on leadership, character, and the role of virtue in public life. He's the author of A Commonwealth of Hope, Augustine's Political Thought, which offers a bold new interpretation of Augustine's virtue of hope and its relevance for politics. His work has been published in leading academic journals across numerous disciplines. Welcome, Dr. Lamb. I'm so excited that you're here to talk Augustine with me on Old Books with Grace.
Thank you, Grace. It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So, everybody who comes on the podcast, I ask them two literary theme get to know you questions. The first is, what is your favorite book or author from more than 50 years ago and why? Which I'm going to bar Augustine. You are not allowed to answer anything Augustine if that was your plan, but who would it be?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I think I'm now finishing up the academic year and thinking a lot about graduation gifts for students at this point. And my favorite books to give students is Letters to a Young Poet by Rilke, the German poet. He wrote these wonderful letters to a younger poet, Kappus. And they range knowing from poetry and art to what it means to live the questions themselves until you graduate without even noticing it, live your way into the answers. And so for me, that book was a very important part of my college experience when I was really grappling with questions about how to live. And Rilke gave me a lot of sort of trust in living the questions honestly and authentically in ways that would open up new ways of thinking and being. And so for me, as I think about books, that book has been very important for me over my life at different times in my life, different letters will help me think about different difficult topics in different ways. So Rilke, I'd say probably one of the books I love the most from the last couple centuries.
Oh, that's lovely. I have to confess, I have not read Letters to a Young Poet. I actually haven't read much Rilke at all. Sounds like I need to remedy that.
He's a terrific writer. It's very poetic. And I think really captures some of the tensions and beauties of the human experience in ways that really open up new ways of thinking. And I think his language is so poetic that it just really inspires me to think about how words can convey meaning and truth.
That's really lovely. I'll have to get to the library and get my hands on a copy. So the second question I have for you is, which literary character do you most identify with and why?
That's a great question, Grace. I think there are many characters who really speak to me in various ways. And one of my favorite writers is Wendell Berry. I grew up on a small farm in Tennessee. And the way that Berry talks about rural life and how he sort of weaves in his own intellectual and spiritual narratives into his novels is really powerful for me, mm-hmm. given my background and upbringing. And so I think his character, Jaber Crow, there are parts of Jaber Crow's experience in his novel, Jaber Crow, that really resonate with my own experience of growing up in the South, grappling with big questions. In fact, there are parts of Jaber Crow's experience when he was in high school, or maybe in seminary, where he actually kind of has lines that sort of echo Rilke, actually, living the questions. And so the ways in which Jaber Crow is grappling with how he ought to be, and then really seeing his community as a source of wisdom and strength, is really powerful for me as someone who grew up in a very similar community.
Mm, very cool. Again, I often have to do this, but I often have to confess that I have not read any of Wendell Berry's novels, which is a bummer for me, but just reflective of my often very large blind spot of 20th century fiction. But I've heard amazing things, and I know that he's written some very powerful novels that mean a lot to folks. So that's,
yeah. I had the chance to interview Barry once in his farmhouse in Kentucky.
Really? Oh, that's so cool.
Wonderful experience. Talk about hope, actually, and the ways in which we think about hope. I think his writing is one like Augustine, where he's really attuned to the realities of the world that might tempt despair, but he doesn't give up. He really sort of offers a vision of hope that's very realistic and attuned to the world, but also that seeks not to see the realities of evil, but the realities of goodness. And I think Barry's writings, both his novels, his poems, his essays, they're really powerful testaments to a kind of realistic, or what he calls at times difficult hope. And I think that's the kind of hope I think we are called to in this moment, to really recognize that hope is not easy and it shouldn't be, but that the practice of hope in our own ways, requires us to be attentive to the world, yet not sort of give in to temptations to despair.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's a good word. And one that you don't meet too often. I think broadly speaking, hope is such a tricky thing that we're going to unpack a lot more, that it's not just this feeling of positivity or right. or an attitude that it's much deeper and both more intentional and more challenging than that. All right, so you've written this wonderful big book on Augustine called A Commonwealth of Hope: Augustine's Political Thought. Before we dive into that, I'd love to chat a little bit about Augustine himself. And he's one of those names that is always out there in the ether. Like, you really can't, even if you're not devoted to the literature of the past, you can't get away from Augustine in a lot of ways. And if you could share with us a little bit about his life and his context, that would be so helpful.
Absolutely. Well, he's a very interesting thinker, in part because of his range of thought and the sheer number of books that he wrote. He wrote 100 books himself in his 76 years, and his influence
is crazy,
really dramatic. There's a lot of words. I think 5 million words overall, which one scholar calculated to be a 300-page printed book every year for almost 40 years. So he would have no trouble getting tenure in this context. But, you know, really with a really profound thinker. He started, you know, in North Africa. So he grew up in North Africa and was very successful as a student in rhetoric. But he couldn't really afford college at the time. His parents were modest or low income. And so he depended on a patron to send him off to college in Carthage, where he became a really excellent student and then went on to teach rhetoric in Carthage and then off to Rome eventually. Where he was teaching rhetoric there. Then actually was appointed the emperor's professor of rhetoric in Milan, at that point the imperial seat of the Roman Empire. And so he was giving eulogies for the emperor and teaching the sons of political officials how to think about rhetoric and to practice rhetoric. But he became very disillusioned with rhetoric and with politics. He felt that rhetoricians were more like flatterers than those who were truth tellers. Hmm. And so he was very concerned about ways that rhetoricians were word sellers, who are really more committed to sort of manipulating or persuading people and actually getting at the truth. And so he gave up his career as a rhetorician, went off to retreat in a nearby friend's villa to be a philosopher, and was at that point converted to Christianity in around 387 or so. And then went back to North Africa eventually to live there. He was planning to just be a philosopher and retire and talk about big ideas with all of his friends and even write a curriculum on the liberal arts. which he began. But then he went to a congregation in Hippo, and there's a very astute bishop there, Valerius, who was very astute and truly recruited Augustine to be one of his priests. He did not want to be a priest initially. He resisted. He actually was in tears when the congregation really enlisted him to be their priest. But he gave in, and after a short sabbatical to study scripture, he became a priest in Hippo, then eventually the bishop. And there he founded a monastery. He was very active in church councils. He wrote tons and tons of works, both books and also sermons and letters, and became, at that point in history, one of the most influential leaders in the Christian church. And so his own influence through his writings and work then, but also in the ways that his writings and work were passed down. He collected all of his works into a catalog and assessed them. And many people went on to sort of really quote Augustine throughout sort of medieval and modern political and moral thought. Peter Lombard, a very influential medieval theologian, has a book of sentences or kind of thoughts that he would use to kind of help teach people how to think about theology. And about 80% of those are quotes from Augustine's texts. So he's very influential in the medieval world, and then came in to be influential not only in the Catholic Church, but also in the Protestant Church. Martin Luther and John Calvin were very deeply Augustinian in their theology. Mm-hmm. And so you see Augustine's thoughts sort of across time, across disciplines, from philosophy and theology to political thought, literature. He wrote what seemed to be one of the first autobiographies in his book, The Confessions. And so he's very innovative in how he thinks about communicating ideas in ways that are accessible and psychologically astute to his audiences.
Yeah, he's such a fascinating character, and his whole life just is interesting. That never really goes away. I was going to ask you to give us the rundown of why he's so influential, but you really covered that well. But maybe we could talk about what of his thoughts and writing so shaped Western Christianity. What were the chart toppers or the big hits of his theology that were so formative for the Western Church, to folks like Peter Lombard and Thomas Aquinas and later on Luther and Calvin?
You know, Augustine has many different themes that really come up in different ways among different thinkers. And one of those is the depth of human sin. He's known for really emphasizing the ways that human beings are fallen and fallible, and that sin for him comes out of a deep pride or excessive self-love. And so his vision of sin as a kind of pride is very influential. In fact, he's often seen to be one of the first theorists of original sin, mm-hmm. the idea that we inherit sin from our ancestors and from Adam in particular, Adam and Eve. And he also really thinks about love in a deep way. He's often seen as the great theologian of love, for how he thinks about love as an animating force of the human life, and how we have to order our loves in the right ways to ensure, he says, that we love God and neighbor and ourselves properly. Mm-hmm. So I think his attunement to the ways in which our loves can be ordered or disordered is very influential in the tradition. Obviously, he also thought deeply about faith, and often he's a great sort of theorist of faith and how faith is understood, though it's quite complex. And I think Augustine's often misunderstood at times how he thinks about faith. It's easy for us to read Augustine in the modern lens and think about faith only as belief. But think about faith in a much more capacious way as a kind of trust, and includes belief, but it's more relational and more contextual than often we give it credit for. So I think there are ways in which Augustine's accounts of sin, love, and faith are very influential. He also has been very influential in thinking about politics and being a pessimist about politics. And mm-hmm. so there's a very strong strand of Augustine that's really trying to lift up this idea that because we are prone to evil and sin, and our loves can become disordered, he's very attuned to the ways that structures in politics can become quite problematic as well, and how leaders and others in politics might be seeking to dominate other citizens to really advance their own glory. And so he's often lifted up as someone who's very acutely aware of the ways in which sin and self-interest might inform our political vision. And so part of what I'm doing in the book is honoring the ways in which he recognizes we can be quite disordered in our political lives, but also not suggesting that Augustine is a pessimist about life on earth. He gives us more grounds for hope than many people often recognize.
Yeah. And what I what I appreciate about how you've just described his life and his influence is that he really is not a one-note guy. He sometimes gets mistaken for a one-note guy, but he's writing in this, in his career, coming out of his career as in rhetoric. So he's got this background in words and language, and then he's also writing out of his role as a bishop, out of his pastoral role, and something that isn't necessarily always true for theologians. Some of them never had much of a pastoral role. They were writing in their studies, and so they may have mentored younger monks or something like that. But Augustine is really writing out of this direct ministry role with the populace that inflects his writing in really interesting ways, I think, and allows for both some of the trickiness of his thought, because he's not being as precise as some of his later commentators maybe would have liked him to be. But he's also really, I think that's part of his popularity, at least for me. When I read him, I went, oh, I feel like he's still speaking to me. Like I'm one of his parishioners, which is not an experience that you get reading every theologian of the past, right? That's not, I don't take that for granted.
Right. Yeah. He's very attuned. I think one thing we often ignore with Augustine is he spent much of his time writing letters and sermons. Yes. And we often lift up his big books like The City of God or The Confessions as his kind of primary text. And they are the ones we most know, at least in the academy. But he's writing most of his words in direct response to his parishioners, those in his community, political officials. And so you see in Augustine's letters and sermons a much more human side, and a side really that's meant to be egalitarian. He's really resisting some of the elite kinds of rhetoric and education that he sees in ancient Rome to make ideas and truths accessible to a much wider audience. And so I really think that Augustine's own impulse to kind of really reach audiences beyond the kind of elite spheres is really powerful. And it also makes him much more human, as you say. And I think that's why many people, when they read the Confessions, for example, or some of his letters or sermons, they feel like he's talking to them.
Yes.
Because he's really speaking in ways that try to get at the depths and the complexity of the human experience. And in the Confessions, he's often quite vulnerable about his own experience. So he's not lifting up an idealized version of himself in the same way that many people might have done in the past. He's really sort of showing a much more complex and at times sort of disordered life to really show his readers how they might, he says, be cheered by seeing how he, even in his own disordered life, has come through out of hope into a much more kind of compelling, according to him, kind of vision of who he ought to be. And so I think that kind of sense of intellectual complexity and grappling with big questions really drives Augustine's own experience in ways that people who I think are really being honest about who they are can identify with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I love about reading Confessions is that it's a book that can be read and picked up even if you have no, I mean, obviously context helps so much, but even if you have no familiarity with the world of the crumbling Roman Empire that Augustine was living in, you could pick up Confessions. And I tell people this all the time, you should pick up Confessions because there will still be so much there for you, even if you don't have that background, which is incredible that a text written so long ago has that power when you read it.
Absolutely.
So how about you? How did you get into Augustine? What was your, what were your first encounters with him? How did you decide to do this deep dive into his life and thought?
You know, I first read Augustine's City of God when I was in college, my first year of college, and part of a course called Search for Values, where we try to figure out what we actually believe about the world by reading lots of great texts from different cultures and parts of history. And so I remember reading Augustine then, and it was a very short excerpt of the City of God, so it wasn't a very comprehensive view. And I remember being very sort of a bit dismayed by Augustine. He seemed very dark and a bit sort of gloomy about the world. And I was more drawn to thinkers who were much more aware of the possibilities of virtue, not just the realities of vice. Mm-hmm. And so I left college, having read that part of Augustine, not particularly enamored by him. I went to graduate school and read more of Augustine and began to see a bit more of his thought in different contexts and how it had been sort of influential on later thinkers. But it wasn't until graduate school and do my PhD where I began to read much more of Augustine's work as part of a course on Augustine and Aquinas initially, and reading Augustine's text, and also reading more of Augustine's texts, like his sermons and letters that often aren't read, especially by a political theorist in my own field of research, was really powerful. And it gave me a much more complex view of Augustine. Also reading more about Augustine's life, growing up, and really grappling with different parts of his own experience in ways that really resonated with my own experience, going up on a small farm in Tennessee. He really was someone who grew up on the edges of empire in ways that he had to sort of get a scholarship, so to speak, to college and find ways he kind of really studied philosophy and began to sort of grapple with big questions. So that part of Augustine's biography really resonated with my own story and background. And so, but I think what was most compelling for me was seeing the ways in which Augustine has often been seen as this great pessimist about the world. And in my field, especially political theory, he's taken to be kind of one of the great theorists of pessimism. And so as I read more of his works, I began to see a much more complex view of hope as a virtue in his thought. And I was really interested in sort of digging deep in Augustine's thought, in part to challenge those Augustinians who invoked Augustine to promote pessimism. So you have some like Reinhold Niebuhr, who are realists and want to sort of focus on sin and self-interest to chasten hope for politics. Yes. While others, perhaps like John Milbank, for example, might be invoking Augustine to sort of encourage hope in the church, but not in the world or in politics. And so I saw various people engaging Augustine for their own purposes, or among political theorists like Hannah Arendt or John Rawls, sort of critiquing Augustine for being too pessimistic. And so I wanted to write a chapter initially of a dissertation or a book on hope, sort of offering a kind of Augustine against the Augustinians. And as I did that work and realized that there's so much more here to unpack and to explore and to really develop, I turned my whole attention to Augustine's thought as a whole. And the book became about Augustine's virtue of hope, not just about one chapter in a larger narrative. So that's kind of how I got into Augustine and began to see a much more complex and nuanced picture of his thought.
Yeah, I was really happy to see your work out. I'm not an Augustinian expert, but I read a good deal of Augustine when I was in graduate school, and always felt like there is this strong narrative about him that when you're looking at him in his context, it just starts to sound a little different. And your book really picks up on those threads of this guy who's responding to his present moment and who's very, very intelligent, but also very pastoral and very pastorally aware. He's not writing, he's sometimes writing to other theologians and theorists and powerful people, but a lot of the time he's responding to the ordinary Christian and their experience out in the world. And so he can't just be like, you know, shut out the world is nothing. And you start to realize that as he's developing his thought. And so your book really upends this whole idea of Augustine as this super pessimistic, grim reaper of Christian theologians, the original sin guy, withdraw from the world, it's going to hell in a handbasket. It complicates this narrative. And so what's really lovely is that this has very real resonances to our present day moment, right? Where all of these things could easily be said right now, right here. The disengage from the world, put all your hope in God alone, which means ignore everything, like that particular thread of hope in God alone. How can Augustine's thought help us to engage with hope in our present day context in an appropriate way? And not merely just sort of wait in passivity for the next life?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think you're right about the context, Grace. I think Augustine's own thought is really responsive to his context. And I think, you know, when he wrote The City of God, it was in response to the sack of Rome in 410. And that was like an event that one scholar has described as sort of 9/11 times 10,000. It was kind of a symbolic act where Rome, this so-called eternal city, was not so eternal. And so many people fled Rome to North Africa, where Augustine was. Many people worried about the fate of civilization. They had either kind of thoughts that sort of that second coming was about to come and that we would see this sort of the end of the world, or that the world, you know, was really just going so badly that we wouldn't actually be able to have any kind of hope for any kind of temporal mm-hmm. life. And mm-hmm. so there was a sense that Augustine is really responding to these concerns that many people have in his own context. And I think he's very alert to the ways in which these difficulties, you know, he died while his city was under siege by so-called barbarians, the mm-hmm. Vandals, at their gates, literally of Hippo. So he's very aware of the ways that war and conflict and violence affect not only politics in the city, but also the church. He was part of a long-going sort of dispute among Catholic Christians and Donatist Christians, including some Donatists, the Circumcilians, who were assassinating Catholic priests. Mm. And in fact, Augustine himself escaped an assassination attempt by taking a different road randomly back in from a different city. And so there are ways he's very alert to the real violence and division of his own time. And so I think given that, the fact that he can give us sort of a very realistic account of what the issues are helps us sort of avoid what he would call the vice of presumption, where we assume things are just fine, that we can be that just be positive about the world. He really sort of chastens that presumption. But he also recognizes we can't leave ourselves or others in despair, because if we despair of the world, what he sees as part of God's creation, then we ignore the possibilities of goodness and the, in some ways, the opportunities to love our neighbors in that context. So I think he's really trying to steer away between presumption and despair. I think he finds the virtue of hope to be relevant to that project. And so what I try to do in the book is show the ways in which the virtue of hope is not this sort of wishful positive thinking that we might think of today as hope, but actually a much more rigorous, realistic habit of character that helps us both recognize reality, but also resist the kind of negative thinking that is so easy and tempting in our current world. And so I think Augustine's own nuanced thought kind of gets beyond the sort of simple binary between optimism and pessimism.
Yes.
That's so prominent, and gives a much more complex and nuanced way to kind of avoid both extreme optimism and extreme pessimism by giving us a realistic hope that requires real attention and practice to do it well. So I think Augustine's own thought there is I think, quite useful for our moment.
Yeah, I really like how in the book you point out that actually even the categories of optimism and pessimism are anachronistic, that these are were they 18th century ideas in origin?
Yeah.
18th century ideas that then we sort of look backwards through our prism just because we're so used to it. I mean, those are very common expressions and how we think about people interacting with the world. But we read that back on to Augustine, who would have basically been like, what in the world does that mean? But
exactly.
That was something I appreciate. And I want to stick a pin in this triad of despair, hope, and presumption that we'll return to in a sec, because I think this idea is really interesting and potentially very helpful for us as Christians as we navigate how to think about earthly politics and the life that we're living right now. But I'm going to stick a pin in that. We'll return to it in a minute. And I want to ask you to expand on this idea that hope is not the feeling of hopefulness, that it's not this affective response to a situation, but that it's a habit of character. Can you unfold that a little bit and tell us how Augustine would define hope and what, according to him, is the proper role of hope in a Christian life?
You know, hope, Augustine thinks, is an affection or emotion. We do have, as human beings, these responses
yes.
to the world. And he thinks that hope, it really responds to objects that are good, we desire them, that they are future objects, that they're not something we possess right now, and therefore they're uncertain, but possible. So
yes.
hope's our kind of response to the things that we might be future goods that are possible to attain, but not yet attained or seen for him. But he recognized that hopes in that context can go wrong. Mm-hmm. They can be right, but they can go wrong. And so we need some kind of virtue or habit of character
mm-hmm.
that can help regulate our affection of hope toward the right objects and in the right ways,
mm-hmm.
and therefore help us avoid improper hopes or vicious hopes, which would be presumption, excessive hope, or despair, the kind of the lack of hope. And so I think he sees the virtue of hope, like his Roman predecessors, as being this habit or disposition of the soul that guides and directs our affections of hope toward the right ends. And so he really wants to think about hope as this way of ordering ordering our loves and hopes toward the right goods. And so I think that's a very different picture than our common view now of hope as this mood or feeling we have about the world. And having a virtue really requires a lot of practice. It's not something you have automatically. It requires being sort of developed over time. And it's also very attuned not only to the objects we hope for, but the people or those we hope in. We actually need people to hope in order to achieve the things that we hope for. And for him, God is the ultimate object and agent of hope. We hope for God, he thinks, but also in God. But he doesn't suggest that we can't therefore hope for temporal goods or in our human neighbors. He actually recognizes that as long as we order these ideas to God and the good, then it is permissible to hope for temporal goods like peace or friendship or health, or to hope in our human neighbors to help us achieve them. So I think Augustine's thought, when you sort of dig down into it, it's much more complex than a kind of either or category. Yes. It's not either or, either hope or pessimism, or God or neighbor. It's actually a much more complex way in which we think about hope as directing us toward the good in the future in ways that keep us going there rather than sort of resting in our own complacency, either in despair where we lack hope or presumption, thinking we actually already have attained what we are hoping for. So both those vices are really about sort of resting too prematurely, whereas hope is kind of the go that helps us keep going in the face of difficulty and delay.
I always like Thomas Aquinas's image of hope as kind of a stretching towards the good. And your words are making me think of hope as almost like as a plant growing, where it's growing towards God, the sun, but it incorporates all these other things with it that, so it's not that you can't bring in hope in other people, hope in temporal goods, but that it's all part of this upward stretching. And if it's divorced from that, then the plant is going nowhere and it's not going to work. But that's the image that your words are making me picture.
That's a beautiful image. I think Augustine, you know, he often in his sermons will use sort of natural or agricultural metaphors to capture his ideas. In fact, he's often preaching to a group of farmers in Hippo. And so he often will use either agricultural metaphors like the one you just used or maritime metaphors from the sea.
We still have that imagery in our society today, but we don't really think about kind of the real ancient history behind the image of hope as the anchor that keeps the ship from floating out to sea in despair, in presumption.
Exactly. Yeah. And he often will say, in addition to hope being an anchor, that the vices of that oppose hope, like presumption, despair, are whirlpools that might sort of suck us in under and sort of farther and farther away from the good. Right. So I think there are ways in which he uses metaphors very richly to open up new ways of imagining hope and these key theological concepts in ways that his ordinary audiences would really understand and appreciate in a good sermon.
I love that. I love, you know, the best teachers are constantly incorporating things that you see and know in your normal life so that your learning is and your spiritual formation is woven in with your just what you're doing in your day to day. And that's how you can unfold the meaning further in your own life. Something that you discuss in A Commonwealth of Hope, because it's one of the sort of stickiest points for a lot of people of Augustine's thinking about faith, hope, and love, the triad of faith, hope, and love, is his order of love. And it's his famous sequence of distinguishing between different kinds of love and using and enjoying is how it's translated into English. And we're only supposed to enjoy God and then use everything and everyone else. And I'm stating it like very baldly, but yes. But obviously this begins to sound to folks like a total rejection of this world and even something problematically utilitarian of other people. You spend a lot of time breaking down this misconception, which is often used in like political theory and in Augustine's like in this idea of Augustine as pessimist about is the world actually, you know, worth participating in kind of deal. And you break this down at length. And could you give listeners a little snapshot about how we should understand Augustine's words on love?
Yeah, well, it's a really complex question, Grace. And I think...
And you don't have to, you know, yeah, I know that you could probably talk about this for a long time.
I guess I often give sermons for sometimes 2 hours. I will not do that here, but I will...
Oh, my gosh. When I read that in the book, by the way, I was like, oh, my gosh, imagine being one of the farmers of Hippo listening to one of Augustine's two-hour sermons.
He often would do this on feast days when he knew that his congregation might be tempted to go out into the festivals and really sort of get into trouble. And so he kind of kept them in the church and often to keep them out of trouble as he understood it. So, but I'll recognize our listeners might not be tempted by festivals in the same way today. But that order of love is very complex. And so the Latin terms that we often translate as use and enjoyment don't quite mean what we mean today with those words.
Yes. And everything's kind of colored by our history of the last millennia plus of thought, where we know to use a person feels really
instrumentalizing and sort of immoral. And yes. So Augustine, if we read Augustine through that later lens, anachronistically, we see a very problematic account. But if we see Augustine's own use of these words in his own context, he actually using words not to say that we should use other human beings as means to ends, but rather that we should see them as kind of proximate parts of a larger goal. And so I sort of translate the order of love not into ends and means, kind of more contemporary ideas of how we relate different goods together, but actually as proximate and ultimate goods. Mm-hmm. And that we use to use something is to see it as a proximate part of a larger whole, and to sort of to order it toward that larger good, not to kind of use it and try to possess it. In fact, I think his order of love, as I argue in the book, is really meant to chasing people from trying to possess or dominate, yes, other people, because it's not ours to, they're not ours to dominate. And so it's the idea that these are actually God's sort of creation, and therefore we should honor them as part of God's being and part of God's creation. And so I think in some ways, what's often been seen as a instrumentalizing account of love is actually meant to resist that kind of domination, yes, and possession. And so that's what I argue in the book, is there's a new way to understand Augustine's order of love that draws on scholarship from people in religious studies and theology. And then I sort of apply that to sort of challenge those in political theory who have a more truncated account,
yes,
of the order of love and what it means, therefore, for the order of hope.
Yes. And I, what I like about this is that it is very, once you kind of begin to break it down, it's a very practical and even somewhat obvious when you think about it, because if you put your hope singularly as a full end in any single person, we all know that it's going to be disappointing and tragic even for both you and the other person, that it's not a wise and actually loving way of being with someone in the world. And that's kind of what this distinction is meant to uncover and divulge. And we even see that in relationships like marriages, where if you're putting all of your hope in your partner, that's going to end up being a real problem in your marriage. In general, it's in all of human relationships. And so this idea that you cannot lay the entire burden of love or the entire burden of hope in another human being is actually immensely practical and part of ordinary life. He's not splitting fine hairs here,
I think in addition to marriage is one practical application of that idea, but also politics. We often,
yes,
hope in one candidate or one party or one election.
Yes.
Therefore,
yes,
when that party or candidate doesn't deliver what we hope for, we then become disillusioned and despair about it. So I think recognizing how we can make one candidate or one party an idol is a really helpful caution, and it helps us think about the different ways we might order our hopes to avoid sort of that kind of political idolatry, and really think about the ways in which we need to kind of have a much more broader conception of what hope might be and what the possible agents of hope who can help us, who they might be as well.
Yeah, that's related to my next question for you, which is that that Augustine, obviously, as do pretty much all medieval thinkers, they talk about faith and hope very closely together. These are two sides of the same coin, basically, in that they are companions. And you draw out the communal aspect of faith and hope. And I think that I'd like to hear more about that in relation to political faith and political hope, because we sometimes get a little twisted in our minds and think of faith and hope as individual activities. You hope in this and I hope in this, you have faith in this and I have faith in this, when Augustine is so often speaking of them as profoundly communal activities, shared activities. Could you unpack that a little bit more for us? Because I that's something that I was finding helpful in relation to some of our present day situations of feeling fairly hopeless very often, politically and socially.
Yeah, you know, in the original Latin, Augustine is writing in faith or fides can mean belief, as you might think is an individual belief, but also it really means trust. And trust is a social relationship of trusting in others and being trusted. And so to keep faith is to be trustworthy in a certain way. And so it really speaks to this relationship between between two people. And so I think there's ways in which if faith is the ground of hope for Augustine, which means that it gives us the kind of assurance that what we hope for is possible, then we have to hope in other people to achieve what we hope for. And I think that kind of social hope is often ignored in Augustine's thought, but also in our contemporary world. And I think what we see now is a sense, as you mentioned, Grace, where we have our individual hopes and we hope they might align somehow, but we're not actually hoping in others to achieve them together.
Exactly.
What I really want to think about in Augustine's thought is how we have to hope in each other, our neighbors, those that we don't know will actually help us achieve what we desire, because we can't know it. We can hope for it. We can't know it. And so it requires a lot of trust in them. And there's real right now a crisis of trust in our politics where we don't trust each other. And so I think in order to begin to define common hopes, we have to find ways in which we can trust each other to achieve common projects. And one thing I like about Augustine's thought, which is implicit, but I think Aquinas makes more explicit in his thought on hope, is the ways in which hoping in someone else might actually boost our love of them, because we're seeking together and build a strong relationship that then in turn bolsters our hope, that the more we can trust someone, the more we care about someone, the more we can rely on them to achieve what we hope for. And that sort of relationship between faith, hope, and love kind of is a kind of virtuous cycle, that the more we love someone and trust in them and hope in them, the more then we can keep doing that work in ongoing ways. So if we can find ways in our culture where we have common projects, and it could be as simple as a community project of some kind or a neighborhood project, we begin to hope in people who might be different from us to achieve certain common goods, then the more we can do that, we can then sort of begin to expand beyond local into broader communities and circles of care. And so I think that kind of rippling of hope outward, I think, is very powerful, and I think could really help to address some of the more abstract and entrenched divisions we see in our current politics.
I like how you put that, of starting local and having it be a rippling outward. Because I do think that's one of the hardest parts about hearing an account like this, is that you say, so you're telling me I'm supposed to hope in my enemies. That's a goal for me, which is a bitter pill to swallow, right? And also you're like, how can I hope? But hope is so specific. That is a big challenge, to say, how can I hope in them? That's like literally the opposite of what we expect from enemies, right? But starting in the place where you are and with people you're around who are different than you, and having it just beginning there seems like a more possible path, though a challenging one, instead of, say, hoping in the presidential candidate that I despise, or fill in the blank, right?
Right. I think Augustine's really attuned to how to persuade people. I mean, this is why his training as a rhetorician is so relevant to his thought. He's really attuned to the ways in which we need to work in a conflict situation to try to persuade the other. And so he gives us various tools for that. In the book, I talk about the ways in which those tools might help us in our politics. So for example, he often recognizes that the best way to persuade is not to try to convince someone of our own beliefs, but to argue on their beliefs, on their terms, about a certain conclusion or outcome. And so we can honor their own beliefs and say, even on your own beliefs, this doesn't seem to be consistent or reasonable. Then that's often more persuasive. And research in social science now shows that to be true, that we often are better persuading others if we engage them on their own terms, not our terms, to try to convince them. He also recognizes that it's often hard to find common objects of love that we might share, but we often can find things that we want to resist together that we either make us angry or find us troubling. And so many social movements in history often try to identify things that we might want to resist, even if we have a somewhat different vision of justice or equality we're holding out and seeking. And so are there ways we can find alignment around things like domination or injustice that we might be able to sort of coalesce around to resist, even if our views of politics or the good might be a little bit different? So I think Augustine's very attuned to the ways in which we can find commonality, even in the face of pretty deep difference.
Now, this brings me back to this important means and balance ratio of hope as the balanced place, and then despair on one side and presumption on the other, is that I think often in our cultural and political landscape, hope is, when we're talking about hope, we're actually talking about presumption, right. I think very often. And so, especially in terms, in our incredibly polarized political world right now, you are kind of often, very often forced in a lot of ways to put all your trust on one side and zero trust on the other because of the nature of it being two sides. But this kind of breaking up of dichotomies can be really helpful. And I still have a hard time, as I think anyone, like Augustine, I think would know this with his parishioners, of applying this in my own daily life and in my attitude towards thinking about the commonwealth, the shared good of everybody. But what do you think that Augustine would say to us about despair and hope and presumption and this triad right now in relation to what we're dealing with in public discourse and political worlds?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he'd be very aware of the temptation toward presumption right now. Mm. I think he really often identifies presumption as a kind of pride that assumes that we know more than we actually do, or that we hope for the wrong things. And often that's, for him, a hope for glory and domination. Mm. And I think you see temptations of a kind of assumption that we know everything ourselves and can achieve everything ourselves, or that hoping for our own glory or a glory of our own, you know, cause is the only kind of hope we can have. So I think you'd be very alert to that on one hand, and also very alert to the despair many people feel when they see these really entrenched problems that we can't seem to solve together.
Yes.
And so I think he would think that hope is the kind of way that would avoid both of those vices. And I think what's important here is the way that other virtues help to cooperate with the virtues to help resist these vices. So, for example, he believes that we need the virtue of humility to avoid presumption, to recognize our own limits and the ways in which we might not know the future, and how those who we might hope in might also be fallen and finite in various ways. So to be very humble about what our hopes are and whom we hope in, but also that to resist despair, we need kind of a virtue of piety or a gratitude that acknowledges those who have helped us along the way. And there are ways in which Augustine's own sense of piety or gratitude is a way of saying, hey, we've seen people in the past who've helped us be where we are. Can we rely on their assistance again to attain what we hope for now? And so there are ways that helps us resist despair. So I think these different virtues can often cooperate to then sort of help us find the right kind of way between the two whirlpools on each side.
Mm. Yeah, that's really helpful. And thinking about that the hope, the virtue of hope, the real practice of hope is going to be informed by these other things. It's not, because again, we're always tempted to sort of, or at least I think I'm often tempted when I see how just there are so many things out there that send me into despair, or on the other hand, make me feel that presumption of like, oh, those idiots. Like I know if it were me, it would be this way, blah, blah, blah. You know, like we're just surrounded by these traps basically, but that hope isn't just this naivete either, that it has these supports of discernment, humility, gratitude, moving it forward in that stretch. that it's not that blind optimism, because I think people it's easy to confuse the two.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you have a beautiful article on hope as a cousin to courage. And I think in Augustine's context, he thought that the other kind of cardinal virtues, you know, courage or fortitude, justice, temperance, and wisdom were very important for other virtues too. And I think courage in this context, you need courage to resist despair.
Yes.
But you also need temperance to resist presumption. So your views are okay. And you need wisdom to figure out how to find the right balance and the right way forward when you have these competing vices. And if you don't order your hopes toward justice, then right. You might be ordering your hopes toward things that might create more domination or more injustice. So I think there are ways in which we need multiple virtues to guide us in this context to hope rightly and well in our current world.
Mm. Yeah, it's helpful, and it's a tricky topic to think about, but I really appreciate it. So for folks who haven't read Augustine and are intrigued by all of this conversation and all of this, his relevance to our sorting through our lives right now, where would you recommend that they begin? How to get into Augustine, how to wade into his world?
Well, I think the Confessions is the obvious starting point.
Of course. Autobiography,
where he really sort of is a very poignant, often vulnerable, and pretty human account of his own life. And it gives a very good sense of who he was and also how he begins to connect his own journey with his larger theological vision. So I think it's the obvious first place to start. I also would suggest a biography about Augustine. Peter Brown's biography of Augustine is magisterial, mm-hmm. and it's really beautifully written, as is, if you want a shorter biography, Gary Wills's biography of St. Augustine is terrific too. Kind of a shorter account that really helps kind of lay out his life and why he's been so influential in our contemporary world.
That's great. Yes, I have not read the Wills, so I will be looking that one up. I've read the Peter Brown, but it is a tome. It's a brick of a book, but it is excellent. So thank you so much for coming on. Where can folks find you online, find out what you're up to, follow what's going on? Where can they do that?
Yeah, my website is kmichaellamb.com, and my articles and books are available there. And my Twitter is KMLamb. So I look forward to hearing from people on Twitter or perhaps through my website.
Great. Well, thanks again for coming on and for sharing about St. Augustine with us. That was your book is lovely, and I was very encouraged by it. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Grace. I love our conversation. And really, I think the question of hope is an important one for our time. So I'm glad that we're able to talk about it today.
Me too.
Thanks again for listening to Old Books with Grace. I'm Dr. Grace Hammond, and you can find me on social media, including Instagram at Old Books with Grace and Twitter at Grace Hammond PhD. And my last name is spelled H-A-M-M-A-N, which is a little tricky, but I have a monthly Substack newsletter too. That's a lot of fun on historical literature and Christian spirituality. It's called Medievalish with Grace Hammond, and you can find it at gracehammond.substack.com. It's been a really delightful season, and I'm so grateful for all you listeners and all the wonderful guests I've had. And I'll see you around in the fall.